December. The weather sucks, but the institute is just perfect. I'm here until September, so anybody wishing to talk to me, I'm on the second floor. For those of you wondering, this is basically an artwork by Shai Humbry. It featured in New York Times a few months ago. The piece is called Black Holes, and it's part of a larger exhibit called Dark Matters. So my plan for today is very, very simple. I just want to tell you the latest news about black holes in extreme situations. This is kind of a long-term project. Myself and other people started some years ago, roughly 5 years ago. Of course, I'm going to give you a very biased view on the subject. This is basically work that me and my team in Lisbon, these guys in red, started 4 years ago together with other people here in black. And for some references, I direct you to these works. If you have any questions, please feel free to interrupt me, okay? So the idea is basically to try and understand generically how black holes behave in very dynamic situations. So why black holes? The fundamental reason is that black holes exist, okay? This is a group of snapshots taken from the center of our galaxy over a decade. And basically, these are snapshots of the stars orbiting around the center of our galaxy. And you see there's something here, okay? There's the ellipse is focused on this point. You can determine the mass of the object. It's roughly 4 million solar masses. We cannot determine the size yet. We know that it must be smaller than 1,000 Schwarzschild radii, okay? There's something there. The least exotic hypothesis is a black hole. I hope this is clear. And the reason why this particular black hole is exciting is because we now have several, well, actually a couple of experiments going on to try and look at this object more closely, either in radio or in the deep infrared. This is the kind of things we are going to be able to do. A couple of years ago, the group in Germany started basically observing this cloud of ionized gas, which is going to pass close to the black hole next year. I'm going to show you now a movie. It's actually a simulation of this cloud as it goes by. This is the year, okay? You can see that it's tidally deformed. Part of the cloud is going to be absorbed by the black hole. Parts are going to be scattered. But this is the kind of things you can do in the optics in the near future. It's very exciting, okay? So black holes exist. We can see them in the electromagnetic spectrum, and I think exciting things are going to happen. I am not going to tell you much about observational capabilities. I'm going to discuss very, very extreme situations, which I don't think we are likely to see in the near future, okay? But they're really interesting from a fundamental point of view. So black holes exist, but the reason why I'm very interested in black holes is because they have no hair. So if you give me a black hole, all you need to characterize it are the mass, angular momentum, and charge, but even charge plays no role in astrophysical settings. Astrophysical black holes are supposed to be neutral, okay? So whatever you use to build a black hole, once you give me mass and angular momentum, I know everything about it. It's kind of amazing because this room alone needs a huge number of parameters to characterize, right? You can give me the mass and hopefully angular momentum is zero, but that's not nearly enough to tell me how this room looks like, right? If you want to characterize the Earth, you're going to have to give me the number of rivers, of mountains, the mass in the mountain, and so on and so forth. So really, the no-hair theorem of black holes really tell you that black holes really do behave as elementary particles, right? A closely related point of view are the uniqueness theorem, that a black hole must belong to the Kerr family. So I'm really neglecting charge here, okay? And the Kerr family looks like this. This is the line element of a Kerr black hole. You see two parameters there, this A, which is the angular momentum per unit mass, and the parameter m, it's the mass of the black hole. Okay? There's an event horizon at the root of this delta guy. Typically, the event horizon for a solar mass black hole is 3 kilometers. If I were a black hole, a 70-kilogram black hole, I would be 10 to the minus 23 meters. This is important, okay? The event horizon is shielding a region in spacetime where things go badly wrong. This is the singularity. Tidal forces are huge, and we strongly believe that quantum effects are necessary. Okay? So in some sense, you can say that horizons are making quantum effects unnecessary or unobservable. This is actually a conjecture. It's called the cosmic censorship conjecture, and it states loosely that whenever you have a singularity, you also have an horizon cloaking the singularity. I'll come back to this in a few minutes, okay? So we have a singularity, we have an horizon, and if you add rotation, something else appears. And this something else is a static limit region where things cannot stand still, okay? This is the ergosphere, and it's denoted by this torus-like region in spacetime. Okay, so if you look at the structure of this delta guy, it has two roots. The outermost root is the event horizon. There's an inner horizon. And when A is larger than a certain value, sorry, I have braces. When A is larger than a certain value, there's no real roots of this guy. And this singularity is basically open to outside observers. Okay? And this effectively imposes a limit of A over M smaller than 1. Right? If you want to have a black hole, then A over M has to be smaller than 1. And this is not a trivial statement, because in SI units, J is basically this guy. Okay? Angular momentum times the speed of light over Newton's constant and mass squared. This has to be smaller than 1. If you plug in numbers, then our sun has a J of roughly 1, the Earth 10 to the cube, and a simple spinning top has a J of 10 to the 19. So black holes spin really, really slowly. Okay? So finally, I'm going to tell you a little bit how black holes behave. And the only way I have to do this is basically to tell you how they sound like. And the sound of black holes are gravitational waves, basically the amplitude of the spacetime ripples as things happen dynamically. In GR, there's 2 degrees of freedom, and I basically tell you how they change, how they make a ring of matter behave when they pass by orthogonally to the screen. And they allow us to measure the radiated energy, momentum, and so on and so forth. So why is black hole dynamics important? Well, the traditional reason is astrophysics and gravitational wave physics. We have several ongoing experiments right now trying to detect them. I think there's other experts in the room on this, so I'll be very brief. But the reason why we want to understand very precisely how black holes behave dynamically is because the main source of gravitational waves for these detectors are black hole binaries. So take a binary of black holes in a quasi-circular orbit, okay? These guys are emitting gravitational waves. The signal looks like this. Of course, they lose energy, so they spiral inwards. The velocity increases. Therefore, the amplitude of the wave increases. Finally, they merge, and they produce a single, possibly spinning final black hole. This is the signal you expect from the binary. This is what you're currently seeing in detectors, okay? So not very a very interesting picture, because the signal is completely buried in noise. And the way we have to actually dig out the signal of the noise is by doing match filtering, which basically means cross-correlating this guy with this guy. And for this to work, you actually have to have a very precise prediction for the waveform, okay? Is it possible to have a glass of water? So a typical signal coming from a black hole merger looks like this. This is the signal coming from when the black holes are very far apart, okay? It's called the in-spiral phase. As I told you, the amplitude increases, frequency increases, and eventually the black holes touch. This is the merger phase. And finally, you have a ring-down phase where you have a single quasi-stationary black hole ringing down to the final object, okay? You can do a lot of physics with this. I'm going to focus especially on this final stage because it's really relevant. And it's relevant because it gives you the spectrum of the black holes. And this means the intrinsic properties of the object, the geometric object itself. The problem of trying to understand the object from how the object sounds is actually very, very old. Hermann Weyl, that many decades ago, was already thinking about this. Okay, and there is this very famous conjecture that by measuring the spectrum of, in this case, a drum, you can actually infer the shape of the drum. Okay. You can dig out on Wikipedia this picture. This is basically how the area of a drum is correlated to the asymptotic properties of the eigenvalues R. So it tells you that the area is related to how the eigenvalues in the spectrum asymptote. Okay? And there was this conjecture by Mark Kak that possibly you are able to measure the shape from the spectrum. Thanks a lot. Sorry for this interruption, but my braces are killing me. Thanks. Fortunately, there was a result in 92 by Gordon Webb and Wolpert that basically disproves the conjecture. You cannot measure the shape of a drum by just listening, by just checking the spectrum. Actually, they give a counterexample of drums with two different shapes and exactly the same spectrum. Okay? Very interesting. Very interesting, but highly contrived. It's a highly contrived situation, and black holes don't have this freedom. Black holes have no hair. They are characterized by three parameters, or two if you're going for astrophysical ones. So you don't really have the freedom to do all of this with black holes, okay? And in fact, it turns out you are able to measure very precisely mass and spin of black holes just by listening to these to the sounds of black holes. So in other words, if you're able to measure sufficiently precisely this stage here, these are basically a set of damped sinusoids, okay? And these are really the characteristic vibrations of the black holes. Then you're able to invert the relation and get mass and spin of the black hole. I'll give you an example. This was actually worked out for Lisa. Lisa is taking a lot of time to fly, but it's a nice example, okay? Of a black hole at 3 gigaparsec, you assume that 3% of the mass of the system goes into the ring down waves, then this is the precision you get when you try to invert those parameters to get mass and angular momentum. And the errors are always less than 1%. It's fabulous. If you're able to detect gravitational waves and the ring down stage of black holes, you'll be able to map roughly the entire universe with astonishing precision. Okay? And even for a fraction of a percent of energy going into these this ring down, you're still able to do pretty well. You're still able to measure mass and spin to within 1%. Really nice. Okay? So you can hear the shape of a black hole. This is astrophysics. When it comes down to fundamental or mathematical physics or whatever name you want to give it, it's very interesting to study highly dynamical situations. I'm going to go through a couple of these issues. The first one is cosmic censorship always preserved? When you, for instance, take two black holes and you collide them at the speed of light, do you always keep an horizon in the space-time? Or is it possible to somehow take the clouds out of the singularity? There's also this nice conjecture by Kip Thorne in the 70s that there is a maximum luminosity, so energy per second, for any process that you can conceive of. And this limit is c to the fifth over g, okay? The only possible dimensionless number in four space-time dimensions you can hook up with c and g. There's a very interesting story behind this. I think I have 1 minute to tell you. I was in Cambridge last year, you know, talking about how black holes behave when you collide them, and about this conjecture that you're able to go really close to this limit when you collide two black holes at the speed of light. So Gary Gibbons, in the end, comes and asks, well, wait, this is very interesting. I'm actually working on this. So where does this entire thing come from? And I say, well, I saw it in Kip Thorne's book. He refers to Freeman Dyson. Freeman Dyson was the guy starting to think about this stuff. And so everybody quotes Freeman Dyson. So the next day I arrive to Lisbon, I have an email from Gary Gibbons saying, oh, a reporter is interested in this stuff. So I told him, you said that Freeman Dyson started this business. So the reporter asked Freeman Dyson, and the guy says, no. Kip Thorne probably thought it was me, but I think it's really him. Somehow he thought I knew about this, but I don't. So it's really Kip Thorne. But it's an interesting number, okay? And before I start throwing black holes at one another at the speed of light, I'm going to first use a simple model to describe this process. This model was first introduced by Weinberg in 64 and used by many other people after. So in this model, I just take two-point particles in flat space-time, okay? They are given by this stress energy, and I throw them at each other head-on, for instance, okay? Flat space-time, two-point particles, head-on. And then I have a final object at rest, okay? If you work out Einstein's equations for this guy, you're going to have an energy spectrum that looks like this. It's flat, so the energy emitted per beam frequency per solid angle doesn't depend on the frequency, okay? And when v goes to 1, so v is the dimensional speed of the object, when v goes to 1, it's actually isotropic. It's a very simple prediction. It's linearized. You don't expect it to be valid for this highly non-linear phenomena, but it's a prediction. Of interest to us, when you start doing these numerical simulations, they are extremely heavy. You want to have an idea of how large has the center of mass energy to be, such that you're already probing kind of the asymptotic limit, okay? Now, this expression predicts first a multipolar structure, so energy emitted per multiple scaling like 1 over L squared, a flat spectrum, but most importantly, at Lorentz factor equal to 3, you are able to radiate 65% of the total maximum possible. Is this clear? So the total, when you make gamma Lorentz factor go to infinity, you radiate a certain amount of center of mass energy. At Lorentz factor 3, you radiate 65% of that amount. So it tells you that 3 is already kind of probing this very large energy regime, okay? So this is an example of a numerical simulation of two black holes colliding at 93% the speed of light. Hugely violent collision, okay? It's an equal mass head-on collision. The colors will tell you how strong the gravitational wave amplitude is. There's an initial pulse of radiation. This is actually just initial data problem. We don't know how to specify initial data such that there is no radiation there. But the process basically ends in just a final black hole ring, Schwarzschild black hole, ringing down until it asymptotes the final mass. Okay? So nothing seriously wrong goes here. This is a typical waveform, so amplitude of gravitational radiation when you increase Lorentz boost. But the interesting thing about this is when you plot the energy spectrum, so it's here, dimensionless energy per frequency as a function of frequency, you realize that this very naive, linear, flat space-time calculation captures almost all of the process. It's fabulous. The energy spectrum is flat, just like the Weinberg calculation suggests. But the best thing is that the number matches to within 5% or so. Okay? So the spectrum actually matches the ZFL or the Weinberg calculation extremely well. And if you think, well, it's a flat spectrum, so of course I need to introduce some cutoff. The natural cutoff in the problem is the ring down frequency of the black hole. So if you do that by hand, you impose the natural cutoff frequency in the problem, then you estimate the total energy in the problem with a linear flat space analysis. And this linear flat space analysis agrees with the full nonlinear calculation to within 10% or so. It's rare. Okay? In fact, it's so great that you can use the functional dependence of the total radiated energy on Lorentz boost to estimate how much two black holes colliding at exactly the speed of light radiate when they collide head on. Okay? So you take your numerical points and you feed them to an expression such as this. And what you get is roughly 14%. So a fraction of 14%, the center of mass energy, is radiated when you collide two black holes at the speed of light. And by the way, this is roughly half the upper bound given by Penrose many, many years ago for such process. So it's a very nice kind of estimate that still obeys, of course, the bound. This is a head-on collision. Of course, you can tell me, well, non-head-on collisions are intrinsically more interesting. And I think the fundamental reason is you have an extra parameter to play with, but more than that, black holes have a bound on the spin, right? So you could think, well, if I make them collide non-head-on with a certain initial angular momentum in the system, perhaps they form something which is spinning above the Kerr bound for that mass. And if they do that, maybe I'm able to violate cosmic censorship by colliding two black holes at close to the speed of light, right? In fact, you can start tuning the impact parameter. It's obvious that if the impact parameter is too large, the black holes just scatter. If it's too small, they collide almost head on. So you can tune them. And what happens, what happens when you start tuning the impact parameter is that if you tune fine enough, you find this process. So again, the same thing. This is spurious radiation. They are about to merge. They give a couple of orbits around one another. You see a pulse coming out, but they don't merge. They zoom out. They do one orbit around one another, and finally they merge. But the interesting thing is that if they had merged in the first encounter, you would produce a naked singularity. So somehow they know, they steer away, they radiate angular momentum, everything is fine now, I'm going to merge. Very nice. You can study how the radiated energy depends on the impact parameter. It's a function, so this is for velocities of 75% the speed of light. Behaves like this. In this case, even if you fine-tune the impact parameter, you're able to radiate at most roughly 30% of the center of mass energy. And the spin of the final black hole is typically 95, 97% of the maximum possible value, such that you have a black hole there. Okay. Of course, if you could ask the question, can I tune the impact parameter and center of mass energy such that I radiate 100% of the center of mass energy? It is in principle possible. It actually was conjectured by several people, decades ago, but it doesn't seem possible. We tried to do this, and the reason why it doesn't seem possible is that radiation somehow always gets focused close to where the black holes are. Let me explain this a bit better by showing you what happens when the black holes scatter, but still the impact parameter is finely tuned, okay?
What do you mean by 100%? You mean nothing would be left?
Right.
That would be a violation.
Yes, yes. It's not a sacred rule, cosmic censorship,
no.
Although it's pleasant that it works. Yes. Yes. I agree. Well, there's several claims that cosmic censorship is violated in some scenarios. So, of course, it would always be finely tuned. And even the original collapse situations by Shoptwick do show that you can have cosmic censorship violation as long as you fine-tune enough the initial data. So that's not really a violation in the spirit of, right? You need generic initial conditions to claim that you violate the sensor.
No example is known where the horizon area is increasing outside of quantum.
Right, I agree. That still doesn't go. That's still fine with this.
No, I'm saying there are some violent examples that, in a technical sense, violate cosmic censorship. But this seems to me to be a much stronger kind of failure.
Perhaps it will still be very fine with you.
In general relativity, the horizon of the black hole has to fall into infinite future non cone. As far as I'm concerned, no. How do we discuss this?
Sorry?
The higher horizon falls in the infinite future non cone.
Right.
So, as far as I concerned as an observer on Earth, this black hole. So, when we discuss the issue of the notion of black holes, observation, we have to concern ourselves with this.
I don't think so. By the way, a disclaimer, I'm showing you data not for event horizons where you have to actually follow the evolution and actually study the entire space-time structure. I'm showing you apparent horizons. But I don't think you have to concern yourself with that issue. Okay, so this is an example of a simulation where the black holes do not merge. They scatter, and yet the impact parameter is finely tuned, okay? So, and this is an example of that case where they do one orbit around one another, and then they go away, okay? And you can see that there must be some kind of focusing going on, because the mass of each individual black hole, which I basically denote by the size of these spheres here, increases after the first passage. We estimate that when the center of mass energy goes to infinity, then each hole absorbs roughly 50% of the radiated energy. So it doesn't seem possible that this scenario exists. So you can never radiate the 100% of the center of mass energy, which is kind of nice. So no cosmic censorship violations also here, okay? This was mathematical physics and fundamental physics. In high energy physics, understanding black hole dynamics is also interesting. There are several scenarios where you can have black hole formation from the collision of particles. I think the most popular of them was the so-called TEV scenarios, where you add extra dimensions in the space-time, and you kind of try to solve some puzzles by introducing another, in this case, the number of space-time dimensions and the typical size of the space-time dimensions. But in any case, let me assume that you can form particles from black holes. You can form black holes by colliding particles. How does this go about? How do you understand such a process? Well, there's something missing here. There's actually two steps that go into this reasoning. The first is, generically, a high-energy collision of two objects results in a black hole. And the second logical step is colliding at sufficiently high energies, colliding particles or colliding black holes ends up in exactly the same physics. So two logical steps. The first step, that you produce generically black holes, can be understood with this Hoop conjecture. It's just a conjecture. It was formulated by Kip Thorne in 72 and states that if you take an object and you produce a hoop with the size of the Schwarzschild radius of that object, and that hoop goes around the object in all directions, then the object is a black hole. In other words, take me, okay? My Schwarzschild radius is 10 to the minus 23. I take a hoop of 10 to the minus 23. It does not go around me in all directions. I'm not a black hole, which is reassuring, okay? But mass gets boosted. So if you boost me to sufficiently large energies, my Schwarzschild radius would get boosted. The hoop size would also get boosted. And at some point, the hoop would pass around me in all directions, right? That's the gist of the argument, that when you collide things at sufficiently large energies, eventually you end up with a black hole, right? But it's just a conjecture. So it's nice to put the conjecture to a test. This was done by Shoptwick and Pretorius some years ago, and by East and Pretorius last year, I think. So the idea is we start with two objects, in this case, two boson stars, not black holes. They have a compactness R over M of roughly 10, okay? So you'd expect that when you collide two of these guys, these are scalar field kind of solitonic configurations. When you collide these guys, you'd need Lorentz factors of roughly 10, because compactness is 10, to form a black hole, right? So they basically started increasing the center of mass energy, and they realized that at this is a case where you have black hole formation. This case has a Lorentz boost of 3.1, roughly. Okay? And this tells you that, at least as far as the conjecture is concerned, it predicted a threshold gamma of 10. It's satisfied. Okay? And people have verified this by colliding neutron stars, different compactness boson stars, and so on. So it seems to be a robust result. Generically, stuff colliding at large energies produces a black hole. So the first step is understood. It's okay. The second step is, if I collide two black holes, is that equivalent to colliding two particles if the center of mass energy is sufficiently large? The reasoning is, well, if you form anyway a black hole, it has an horizon. This stuff is going to be cloaking all the multipolar structure, all the hair of the particles anyway. So you can't see it, right? So all the multipole structure of particles gets basically buried inside the horizon. This is the rationale, okay? So we started testing this last year. So we started doing the following. You collide two black holes, non-spinning black holes, at some energy and some impact parameter. You can tune the impact parameter to see when this gives rise to a single black hole, okay? So you basically find the threshold impact parameter for a result in a single spinning black hole. Now, instead of colliding two non-spinning black holes, you do the same game, but with black holes that are spinning with the spins aligned. So you throw them like this. And then you repeat the same thing with anti-aligned spins. You do this. And in each case, you numerically compute the critical impact parameter for black hole formation, okay? This is very costly computationally. It takes 1 or 2 years of intense numerical work to do, but it's doable, right? And I'm showing you here the critical impact parameter for black hole formation as a function of center of mass energy, of velocity, if you wish, right? The red dots are anti-aligned case, blue ones are aligned, blacks are non-spinning. And of course, at low energies, this multipolar structure matters. The numbers are different, but it's interesting. As the energy grows very large, basically it's irrelevant whether the black holes are spinning or not, okay? And I think this is a very nice confirmation that the second logical step also works. It doesn't matter what you're colliding, okay? If it forms a black hole, you can throw whatever you want. It always gives you the same. And this is nice because black holes are easy to collide. They have three parameters, doesn't take a lot. Well, it does take a lot, but it's simpler than other stuff, okay? So black holes do form in high energy collisions, and collisions of point particles are well described by collisions of black holes, okay? So this is usually summarized by saying matter doesn't matter. Doesn't matter what you throw in. And this finishes my first half. I'm now going to spend 10 or 15 minutes on actual matter outside of black holes. Are there any questions on the first half? Yeah?
So the last time you were referring to the LHC or some possibilities, but there you're dealing with quantum particles. So how exactly can you extrapolate these calculations to that situation?
You cannot. So this is fully classical. I'm always assuming that the center of mass is way larger than the 1 DeV, say, that you would predict for this for the Planck scale, okay? So my black holes are always classical. I'm completely neglecting quantum effects, okay? Okay, so now let me add matter to the black holes. They are no longer evolving in vacuum. I'm going to consider matter fields around black holes. I'm going to focus on one and one only mechanism around black holes, which is superradiance. Superradiance consists in the following. You throw a wave packet into a rotating black hole. The wave packet gets scattered with an amplitude which is larger than that of the incoming wave. Okay? So you extract energy out of the black hole. This is the wave analog of this Penrose process, or if you wish, it's also a consequence that things have to co-rotate with the black hole. They have rotating black holes have this ergosphere where things are forced to co-rotate along with the black hole. This is just a consequence of that. Okay? But by throwing matter in, you can basically steal energy away from the black hole. And if the waves are monochromatic, the condition for superradiance is that they have sufficiently low frequency. Okay? And this is the condition. The frequency of the wave has to be smaller than the angular frequency of the black hole. Okay? As far as I know, actually, superradiance was only tested at the linear Novak reaction level on the geometry. We have now actually some simulations to show it does happen even when you do fully nonlinear simulations of black holes. This is an example. I'm throwing a Gaussian wave packet into a black hole. The black hole is rotating at 80% the maximum possible value. And I'm plotting in red the spin of the black hole. It decreases. And in blue, the mass of the black hole. And if you zoom in, there are certain instants where the mass actually decreases. So this is actually superradiance working at the full nonlinear level. We are evolving the geometry. Okay?
What's going on?
No, it's a scalar radiation. Well, actually, you can also do it with gravitational wave factors. Yeah.
So what do you mean by mass, then? How you define it, sorry?
The mass, so I'm basically following the mass of the black hole.
How do you extract that number?
Well, by computing the horizon area.
So from horizon area.
Yeah. Okay. You can compute the spin by knowing how deformed the horizon is. Okay? So you compute area, the deformation of the horizon.
And what horizon? An apparent horizon?
Yes. Right. Yes. Okay. You can also do this for the event horizon. We haven't done that yet. it's much more costly. Anyway, superradiance exists. And once you realize superradiance exists, you can hook up kind of exotic things. The first is fission bombs. This was a process, I think, Tucholsky and Press and others, and even Zaldovich, many years ago, thought of. And the idea is simple. Well, if one black hole super scatters a wave, if I assemble a cluster of black holes, it's possible in principle that I have a kind of efficient system, right? I throw in a wave packet, this guy super scatters the wave, goes to another one, and so on and so forth. This is very familiar. It's the nuclear fission bomb, right, in black hole systems. It turns out it doesn't work, because for this process to work, the cluster, it's a very simple calculation, the cluster would have to be contained within its own Schwarzschild radius, okay? And the calculation is very simple. You want the mean free path of each of these gravitons or scalars to be smaller than the cluster size. So it doesn't work, okay? But what does work is by enclosing one single black hole in a spherical mirror. This was called the black hole bomb. And this is what you do. You have a rotating black hole. You generate some disturbance around it. And the disturbance is kept in a compact support. So say you put a spherical mirror around the black hole. What happens is this. One single wave packet goes, gets amplified, reflects at the wall, goes into the black hole, it's superradiantly amplified again, and so on and so forth. Right? So you have this exponential cascade of energy. Of course, this is done at the expense of the black hole rotational energy. This is not very interesting for people who actually do astrophysics, because we don't know of any actual mirror, right? We don't know of any cavity with some wall which is perfectly reflected. But there are some natural barriers out there. One of them is not a singularly flat spacetime. It's anti de Sitter spacetime. Has a very nice time-like boundary. I think Roberto Emparan or somebody else calls it the covariant box. So this mechanism, this black hole bomb mechanism, is very active in spacetimes with other kinds.
What do you mean by nature there?
Sorry?
Very nature, you have ideas.
I mean the universe at large.
But it's not ADS, I can tell you that.
Yes, yes.
The imaginary.
Yeah, exactly, the imaginary universe. So it does work in other kinds of asymptotics, or if the matter is non-trivial. In particular, if the matter, if you, instead of scattering a massless field off of a black hole, you scatter a massive field, then massive fields behave as kind of a bound state around the black hole. And this bound state can extract as kind of a tail that extends into the ergo region and can keep extracting energy away from the rotating black hole. Okay? This is how it works. If you work out the evolution equation for a massive scalar field, you will find that it's governed by a Schrodinger-type equation with an effective potential that looks like this, okay? It has some peak at close to the horizon and develops a negative well close to the ergo region, okay? And it's here that the instabilities may develop. You can actually kind of estimate the instability growth timescale. I'm parametrizing that by characteristic frequencies. So I do a Fourier kind of ansatz, and the timescale for growth of the instability is the inverse of this guy. M is the black hole mass, mu s is the scalar field mass. Okay? So for very light fields, the instability timescale is huge. Okay, it's very large. So the question is, you know, is this process interesting at all? I mean, can I find or use this effect in any possible useful way? Well, you can. Because if you have a rotating black hole out there, and we have plenty, okay, if this instability is present, I will take an initial field disturbance, and it will behave like this. Okay, this is the most dominant unstable mode around a Kerr black hole. This Kerr black hole is spinning at 90% the maximum possible value. And the simulation is for a massive vector field. Okay? Of course, you have to wait a very long time to see the instability growing. But the gist of this is, if you wait long enough, the field is going to drain rotational energy away from the black hole. Okay? So when you observe black holes, if they are spinning, it tells you something about how effective the mechanism is. Right? So the idea, again, wait. I don't know what happened to my plots. They went away. So it's good to have internet in the room. So what you can do is the following. You can start taking known black holes and their respective masses and plot an effective instability window. Okay? What I'm doing here is taking several black holes along with the associated measurement error in spin and mass and putting them in a plot. This plot gives you the following. These lines here are the lines for which the instability timescale is smaller than a Hubble timescale and a Salpeter timescale and 10 to the 4 years. So anything within this region should have lost the rotational energy in timescales which are shorter than these numbers, okay? Than 10 to the 4 years. So you don't expect to actually see any object spinning if there exists a vector field with a mass, say, of 10 to the minus 20 electron volt. Okay? And I remind you that the particle data group has a bound on the photon mass of 10 to the minus 20 electron volt. So if you believe this mechanism, and there are some things I should point out afterwards, if you believe this mechanism, it's already imposing constraints on vector fields which are stronger than those we currently know of, right? The idea is very simple. If the instability is active and vector fields have mass, they should have extracted rotational energy away from black holes. We should not see black holes spinning. Yes?
For photons, though, photons have self-interactions. So self-interactions that are quite large, actually. So those will increase super radiant. So does the bound apply to photons? To our photons.
This applies only to linearized calculations. This is the problem I'm going to say next.
Okay.
Nonlinear interactions are higher order here. Okay. I'm going to come into that point later.
Well,
the plot is not here. It's the same plot I showed you on the paper. These results depend very, very weakly on the fit coefficient you use to describe the data, and they depend very, very weakly on the super radiant threshold. The point is this. I think the main point is how the time scale scales with the mass of the field. Okay, it's a very strong dependence. So when you invert this relation to get a time scale, it's basically a very large route that you have to take. So it's not strongly dependent on the numbers you put in, on the coefficients you use to put in front of this. Okay? Okay, so let me summarize my talk. I think black hole physics is a very fascinating topic in GR, especially extreme situations where black holes are present. There's a lot to do. I showed you, I think, only the beginning of things. We don't understand fully how to do different kinds of asymptotics. We understand very poorly how to play around with charge. We don't even understand how to specify in a decent manner initial data for such high energy collisions. Okay, there's a lot of things to do here. The superradiant effect is very apparently effective and useful, but there's a lot of stuff we don't know. We don't know how accretion disks modify this mechanism. We don't know if the instability saturates at some point and nonlinear effects, either self-interaction or geometry distortion, are going to quench the instability or not. So there's a lot of things to do. But I think the future is very bright. So thanks a lot.
We'd like to give students the first chance for questions. Okay, well, let's throw the floor open for a question from anybody. Students, of course, can still ask questions.
When you have a binary black hole spin, it's similar to black holes that you collide between the non-zero impact parameter. So they're rotating and getting closer. Is it possible to sometime you get the angular momentum of the merging black hole bigger than enough to just have an extreme Kerr black hole, or just
it is possible. What happens, so I showed you an example where you throw things, so it's not a kind of a quasi-circular merger, right? You're throwing things from infinity. And I showed you an example where they can't merge, because if they merge, there would be this ultra-spinning black hole. You see this phenomenon also in black hole binary simulations. They are called the hang-up. They take a lot of time before merging, because they need to radiate the excess angular momentum. So you kind of see this phenomena, and the final black hole is spinning very highly. Unfortunately, even in that case, we can start with highly spinning black holes in the initial data. Okay, so we can start with black holes spinning above, last time I checked, 93% of the Kerr bound. So, but I think everything points to the fact that you preserve the Kerr bound. But yeah, the final black hole can be actually rapidly spinning.
So you said your simulations were for massive vector fields, right?
Yeah.
So that means, could you like a bit clarify? So what is the theory? So you just, it's just Maxwell plus?
Yeah, it's a Frog action.
Okay.
So is if I. I'll need to go again.
Why did you use the scalar?
We can use the scalar, but the scalar we know already. So the purpose here was to bound the vector field mass. Well, basically it was to go beyond what we have.
But you get similar limits for a
yes,
scalar?
Yes, yes. The power law dependence is different. So the power law dependence here this power law dependence is different. This is the scalar case. The vector case has the 6 here, but the results are pretty much insensitive to this exponent. But yeah, the behavior is similar.
If you bound the mass of the carbon?
If we have a consistent theory, actually we are working on a kind of fierce poly thing right now. Exactly the same thing happens. The problem is, it seems to me that the gravitational mass is already highly constrained. And I don't know if this kind of physics is going to give you any bound which is better than that. So, yeah, but that would be interesting.
So how did you get the ground and photon mass? Are there cases where you really can measure the spin of the purple? I mean. I mean, astrophysics.
Yes. So it's measured basically from the properties of the accretion disk.
Okay, so.
So,
in that case, you have other things going on, like the accretion disk, and then you have other things spinning up the black hole.
Unfortunately,
so
yes.
How would you?
I don't know. The honest answer is that this is very simplified.
Yeah, can I say something about that? So actually, if you look at how the black hole accretes, even if it accretes very fast, the mass that surrounds the black hole from the accretion disk is actually a tiny, tiny fraction of the mass of the black hole. You can estimate that within a sparsely radius of the black hole, for a black hole that accreted close to Eddington ray, there is roughly like 10 to the minus 20 of the black hole mass for solar mass black hole. So that's a tiny fraction of the black hole mass. So I don't think accretion is enough. So the other way you can see this is that the time scale that's relevant for accretion.
Not enough to depth the instability.
No, it's not enough. So the other way to see this is that the time scalars that you have correctly compared to is that the time scale for accretion is very long. So as long as you're if you put numbers in it, so I can give you a number. If you take a solar mass black hole, the instability rate can be 100 seconds. The accretion rate is 10 to the 8 years, 10 to the 7 years. So there is a lot of, that already tells you that accretion is not enough to impede unless the rate becomes comparable to the accretion rate, the instability rate, then I don't think accretion is enough to impede the superadditions. So it will occur.
Well, thank you.
But just to follow up on that, so let's just a scalar field, which is easier to understand. So the idea is that you have a uniform bath of a scalar particles, and then somehow your angular momentum goes into those, or?
So can you repeat the question?
No, he's saying the vacuum of the scalar field is unstable.
Right.
In
yes.
the presence of
yes.
the rotating
yes.
particle. I see.
You can think of it as a Lazin effect. You have a bound state of that particle with a black hole, and that, so you can think of it as a hydrogen atom.
Mm-hmm.
So in a hydrogen atom, of course, you have electrons, right? So you can only put two in the bound state. But if you have scalars, you can put
many.
And then the if you apply a creation operator, you get an N enhancement, right? So it's like a Lazin effect. So it gets coherently enhanced. This is what happens. So think of it as a bound state of particles all sitting at the same state that is growing exponentially in time.
I'm just wondering, I mean, are you violating like the No-Hertz theorem somehow?
These are not charged particles.
Yeah.
This is just carry angular momentum. They have no information about it.
Yeah, okay.
It's just carry angular momentum and mass. You change the the properties of the black hole that's already there. It doesn't change anything else.
So does this set bounds then on dark matter candidates?
Yes.
But it's not a bound that tells us something different about the candidates.
Not for the scalar particles. No. For vectors it is, and actually for Higgs photons it's also a very competitive bound. But again, just not on the accretion disk thing, but I think nonlinear effects are still largely known. This way.
There is this group in Japan that has done simulations for the axion.
But they consider, so we are finding something slightly different.
Yeah, we can talk about, I know your paper, so we can talk about it later, but let's talk about it later. I think it will happen as long as non-linear effects can impede superadditions,
yeah.
actually. Mm-hmm. And they are important. The good thing about things is you have to make sure that self-interactions, for example, if they're anything stronger than gravitational, they will come in before the superadditions takes order one of the, so you know that the self-interactions have to be soon, I mean, very close to gravitational. So they have to be really, really suppressed in order for nonlinear effects to be non-important later.
Can you elaborate just a little bit on what's the instruction in terms of initial data? So you seem to have issues. You said there was a problem in terms of forming decent initial data.
Well, the problem is very simple. The problem is that when you start any simulation,
mm-hmm.
you need to start at some point in time and
sure.
space, right? And we don't know how to specify the initial conditions in such a way that the only thing you have is a natural evolution of a black hole binary that came from infinity, right? What you have is always a couple of black holes and some radiation around them. This is what the first pulse that you saw in those simulations is actually just that extra stuff that you can't control.
Okay, so you say just, because I would, you know, just write down the constraints and then say, you know, do a little numerical relaxation, and you say that
you
get in trouble that way.
You satisfy the constraints the same, but you still have that extra chunk. What you can do, which is what we did, is you solve the constraints, you start the simulation, and you wait until that jump of radiation leaves the computational domain. You can do this, but this only goes that far because we are talking about collisions which are roughly at the speed of light. So the black holes themselves travel with the radiation that you're waiting to leave the domain. So as we increase the center of mass energy, you have to start the black holes farther and farther apart. So it's a big problem, right? So of course, some of these simulations take almost half a year.
In the context of the super radiance, I don't know of many massive vector particles that we have that you'd be testing directly with this. But there are certainly astrophysical things that are like that. So I can imagine Alfvén waves, which is certainly a massive vector particle, albeit in a medium. And I know if I put a magnetized medium around a black hole, I drive jets. And so can I imagine jet production as in the context of driving the super radiance instability?
I think the problem is how efficiently you're able, we should talk about this. I think the problem is how efficiently you're able to track these modes.
Mm-hmm.
So super radiance is typically very small. The maximum gain for electromagnetic waves is 4%. For a nearly extreme black hole, right? For a very finely tuned radiation. So you need kind of a cavity that is a perfect container within 1% or so. And I think that's a major obstacle against using this, but it maybe. The thing is that it's so dirty when you start doing astrophysics that real astrophysics.
I think some of these kinds of instabilities are much more effective for a neutron star, for example, rotating neutron star. Is it that much harder to do?
Well, this kind of instability...
Not this one exactly, but other instabilities associated with rotation that are kind of analogous to this.
You mean the R mode and so on?
Yes.
Yeah. I'll show that way.
So how much harder is it to adapt these?
Well, it's a completely different problem. Neutron stars are a completely different thing. So, if you're into neutron stars, yeah, neutron stars. Right?
Any other questions? Let's thank Victoria.